This is the second tape in a series by Robert J. Dunsweiler, Associate Professor of Systematic Theology and Apologetics at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Well, let me proceed on to capital B, the nature of death. That's our main burden for tonight. The nature of death, capital B. Now, pursuing the same, essentially the same format as we did under capital A, we'll look at relevant scriptures, and then we'll look at development of the doctrine. Now, the relevant scriptures, we'll run through them rather rapidly, not that we want to give short shrift to the scriptures, but to get them before us and get a pattern of scriptural thought before us and then proceed with the development of the doctrine. Genesis chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "From any tree of the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat from it you shall surely die." Genesis 3, 17 through 19. Then to Adam he said, that is, God said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat from it,' cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." Now that latter part is the part directly related, of course, to the concept of death. Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. "Therefore, just as through one man sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men, because all sinned." 1 Corinthians 15, 21 and 22. "For since by a man came death, by a man also came the resurrection of the dead." And then Paul explains who are these two men. "For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ all shall be made alive." Matthew chapter 10, verse 28. Jesus is speaking. "And do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul." That's interesting. They're able to kill the body, but they're not able to kill the soul. "But rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." Now we're going to look at these terms concerning these intermediate states and the final states of the unrighteous and the righteous under points C and D under this outline. But for the present, we're just looking at verses which pertain to death. Luke 23, verse 43. "And he said to him," Jesus said to the criminal, "Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise." Today. Verse 46. "And Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, 'Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit.' And having said this, he breathed his last." Verse 52. "Joseph, a man of Arimathea, a member of the Sanhedrin," a good man, "this man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And he took it down and wrapped it in a linen cloth and laid him in a tomb cut in the rock where no one had ever lain." The same day. By the way, he laid him in a tomb the same day. But Jesus said to the criminal, today you shall be with me in paradise. James chapter 2, verse 26. For just as the body without the spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead. Luke chapter 16, verses 22 and 23. Now it came about that the poor man died, and he was carried away by the angels to Abraham's bosom. And the rich man also died and was buried, and in Hades he lifted up his eyes, being in torment, and saw Abraham far away and Lazarus in his bosom. Now it does not say that the poor man, Lazarus, was buried. His body may have been cast on a dump or a heap of some sort, but yet it does say that the rich man was buried, no doubt in pomp. But the poor man was carried away, and the rich man lifted up his eyes, even though both were dead. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Paul says, therefore, verse 6, being always of good courage, and knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight. We are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord. Absent from the Lord, at home in the body. Absent from the body, at home in the Lord. Philippians chapter 1, beginning at verse 21. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if I am to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which to choose. That is, to continue to live or to die. But I am hard pressed from both directions, having the desire to depart and be with Christ, for that is very much better. Yet to remain on in the flesh is more necessary for your sake. John chapter 5, verse 26. For just as the Father has life in himself, even so he gave to the Son also to have life in himself, and he gave him authority to execute judgment, because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming in which all who are in the tombs shall hear his voice and shall come forth. Those who did the good deeds, to a resurrection of life. Those who committed the evil deeds, to a resurrection of judgment. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 26. The last enemy that will be abolished is death. And then Revelation 21, verse 4. And he, that is God, shall wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall no longer be any death. There shall no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. Now, to the development of doctrine. Arabic 1, death is the cessation of life. Now that sounds like the worst truism that you ever heard. That sounds like a pure redundancy not worthy of expression. Death is the cessation of life. See, I said it again. And I'm not only going to say it, but I'm going to expand it, no less. So, small a, physical death is the cessation of physical life, the cessation of physical activity and processes in the body. This includes cessation of movement, of respiration, that is breathing, of blood circulation, that is of heartbeat, of metabolism, which is the building up and the destruction of protoplasm, and of brain activity. That is, here we're speaking of the cessation of brain waves as traced by an EEG, an electroencephalogram. This cessation of vital processes results in physical decomposition and decay of the body. Some of you who have some medical knowledge are aware of how quickly that process begins and how important it is to try to reverse that or at least stem it as soon as possible. There's a present emphasis on lay people getting training in cardiopulmonary resuscitation, which is an attempt to quickly halt that potential for decomposition and breakdown. Now, just a footnote here on point A. Death is currently defined medically in three ways. The first medical definition of death is the absence of clinically detectable vital signs. Obviously, that's what the rescue squad looks for. They don't have an electroencephalograph right handy, and besides, that usually takes a fair amount of time to set up. But they look for clinically detectable vital signs, the kinds of signs we were speaking of just a moment ago when we spoke of movement, respiration, blood circulation. The second definition for death, as it is currently defined medically, is the absence of brainwave activity. That is, if you cannot detect any vital signs, then the next question is there any residual brain activity? Are there any brain waves detectable? That's the second definition. Now, of course, these definitions become very important when you get into legal questions. Oh, boy. Then, suddenly, everything of this nature becomes very important. When you talk about pulling the plug, or you talk about what constitutes death, as far as a number of issues, very, very important issues. The third definition of death, as it is defined medically, is an irreversible loss of vital functions. That third definition is the one I'm using in this discussion. An irreversible loss of vital functions. You cannot reverse it. Now that's really death in the sense in which I am employing death, not the sense in which some of the writers who talk about death employ it. They don't talk about that. When they get to that third definition, they say, we're not using it in that sense. Irreversible loss of vital functions. So, that brings us to small letter B. Talked about physical death, now spiritual death. Small letter B. Spiritual death is the cessation of spiritual life. Innocent statement. Obviously, it must be unpacked because it's very complicated, not simple. Spiritual death is the cessation of spiritual life, the cessation of godly activity in the soul/spirit. This includes cessation of vital relationship to God and cessation of activity characterized by holiness and righteousness. And here is why it becomes so important, right at this point, to clarify what we mean by spiritual death. Spiritual death does not mean the cessation of all activity in the soul-spirit. For the spiritually dead, soul-spirit is involved in ungodly activity. It's active. It's not non-existent. It's not dormant, it's not asleep, it's active. It's active in trespasses and sins. This is a curious point, but it must be made. Activity of the soul spirit in sin is not called spiritual life in Scripture. It's called spiritual death. Now, see, that's odd because we don't use death in the sense of physical death in that way. By physical death, we mean cessation of activity. But here, spiritual death, you have the spiritually dead soul spirit being active. It's active. And yet, activity of the soul spirit in sin is not called spiritual life. See, it's activity, but it's not spiritual life. It's called spiritual death. Spiritual life involves activity in righteousness. Spiritual death involves not the cessation of all activity, but activity in unrighteousness. In this sense, spiritual death is different from physical death. Because when we take the model of physical death, we think immediately of cessation of activity. That's the first thing you look for, cessation of activity. Here is a spirit, a soul spirit, which is spiritually dead, but yet is very active. So we're using dead not in the sense there that the soul spirit ceases to exist or goes to sleep or becomes dormant, becomes inactive, but we're using spiritual death there, death now in more of an ethical sense. When was the human soul spirit ever spiritually alive? Obviously, if human beings come into this life already corrupt and depraved, as Scripture teaches, then all human beings who are born into this life are already spiritually dead. So then the question may properly be asked, what relevance does this have when you talk about spiritual life? Obviously, it has relevance only to Adam before the fall. He was spiritually alive. He walked with God. He was alive to God. He knew God personally as well as factually. And he was characterized by righteousness and holiness before the fall. But of course, he lost that. And that's part of spiritual death. Spiritual death then takes place for mankind at the fall, for the whole of mankind. All men died in Adam, not only physically but spiritually, which makes the fall a very important event indeed. Being made alive starts in regeneration, starts in the new birth, but it's not complete. In other words, the being made alive continues as a process. It begins and then continues. So that you can say, we are being made more and more alive, and that one day we're going to be made completely alive to righteousness and to holiness and to God. Now, I know that that's not the usual way we speak of newness and being made alive. You think when you're alive, you know. But not in this sense. In this sense, you're made alive, and that's a beginning. But then you are to grow. You are to progress. You are to become more and more alive. And obviously, you could say, well, doesn't that mean if there's still sin in your life, that there's some sense of death in your life? Yes, that's right. So that, of course, the idea is there to die more and more to sin. In other words, get out of death more and more and become more and more alive to righteousness. So that's becoming more and more alive spiritually. Well, this brings us to number two. See now, it wasn't such a simple statement, death is the cessation of life. Started out very simple. Two, Arabic two. Physical death is the dissolution, the dissolving, if you will, of the union of the material body and the non-material soul spirit. By the way, this union is frequently referred to, although not in theological terms, when we hear various medical problems being spoken of as psychosomatic. There we have a very real illustration of the union between the soul spirit and the body. And what takes place in one affects the other, and that goes both ways. That's interesting. What takes place in one affects the other. There's a very real union between the soul spirit and the body. And death is a dissolution of that union. Now we go into small letters. Small a. This dissolution is unnatural and abnormal. See, here's another thing that's unnatural. Sin is unnatural. This dissolution is unnatural. Of course, it's a result of sin, so we have an unnatural result from an unnatural factor. It is unnatural and abnormal. It is alien to human beings. It is a rending apart of components which belong together. And, of course, it is a result of mankind's fall into sin. Small letter B. This dissolution does not necessarily involve a spatial separation of the body and the soul spirit. I didn't say it doesn't. I said it does not necessarily. See, that's important. So don't write it doesn't involve. Say it doesn't necessarily involve a spatial separation of the body and the soul spirit. It requires only a dissolution of the union. That's all that it requires. A dissolution of the union. However, quickly we must add point C, because that isn't saying enough. See, that leaves an open question. Small c, this dissolution does, however, see, having said what it doesn't, now we have to say something it does. It does, however, involve a passing of the soul spirit from one state or dimension into another. Now, point number three. Physical death does not mean the cessation of the soul spirit's existence. Now, here I have a lot of points to make. Following physical death. Now, here I'd like to make a lot of disclaimers. Following physical death, the soul spirit does not cease to exist, is not absorbed into a larger or more ultimate reality, does not fall into a deep slumber, does not pass into a state of absolute unconsciousness, does not pass to an astral plane, does not enter another body in order to begin a new existence. It's interesting, by the way, what the people who do a lot of writing in the area of parapsychology and the occult. It's interesting to see what they say about reincarnation and what some of the spirits who are purportedly contacted by spirit mediums, it's interesting what those spirits say about reincarnation, how they contradict one another. That's very fascinating. Fascinating. The whole area is fascinating. That's the trouble with it. You can get too fascinated. We don't want that either. Does not enter another body in order to begin a new existence. Does not wander about the world making unexpected appearances, frightening bad people, encouraging good persons, throwing dishes or moving furniture, or haunting houses and old castles. And does not act as a familiar spirit to witches or mediums. By the way, that's a technical term, familiar spirit. Does not act as a familiar spirit to witches or mediums, revealing the future, comforting the bereaved, convincing the scoffers, and helping the mediums to make a living and to write books about their success in contacting the dear departed spirits. Rather, the Bible teaches that the soul spirit, following physical death, continues in a conscious, disembodied existence and a particular place until the resurrection and judgment. Now, I said we wanted to look at some writings about the question of death and life following death, or the continued existence of personality in a conscious and disembodied existence. First of all, let me mention a book by Raymond A. Moody, M.D., Raymond A. Moody, Jr., M.D., entitled Life After Life. This is a fairly widely sold book. It has at the top of it actual case histories that reveal there is life after death. The burden of this particular book is to show by near-death experiences and by experiences of people who were pronounced clinically dead, to show what kinds of things they experienced. And then when they came back to life or consciousness, what they had to tell about that experience. And Moody raises the question as to whether that can tell us something about what it is like after physical death. I'm just going to mention a few things that he says in this book, Life After Life. He says, at the present time, I know of approximately 150 cases of this phenomenon. That is, experiences of persons who were resuscitated after having been thought, adjudged, or pronounced clinically dead by their doctors. Secondly, the experiences of persons who, in the course of accidents or severe injury or illness, come very close to physical death. Thirdly, the experiences of persons who, as they died, told them to other people who were present. Later, these other people reported the content of the death experience to me. So he has about 150 cases that form the backbone of this particular book. And in this work, he says that despite the wide variation in the circumstances surrounding close calls with death and in the types of persons undergoing them, it remains true that there is a striking similarity among the accounts of the experiences themselves. The similarities amongst various reports are so great that he picks out about 15 distinct elements in the experiences which are fairly common amongst the cases. They occur again and again in the reports of the people describing their experiences. So he constructs a brief, theoretically ideal or complete experience which embodies all of these 15 elements, and then he gives them. And here is the scenario. He doesn't list them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, but just here is a paragraph in which he lists the 15 elements common to all of these near-death or death experiences. I quote from him now, pages 21 and 22. A man is dying, and as he reaches the point of greatest physical distress, he hears himself pronounced dead by his doctor. He begins to hear an uncomfortable noise, a loud ringing or buzzing, and at the same time feels himself moving very rapidly through a long, dark tunnel. After this, he suddenly finds himself outside of his own physical body, but still in the immediate physical environment, and he sees his own body from a distance, as though he is a spectator. He watches the resuscitation attempt from this unusual vantage point, and is in a state of emotional upheaval. After a while, he collects himself and becomes more accustomed to his odd condition. He notices that he still has a body, quote-unquote, but one of a very different nature and with very different powers from the physical body he has left behind. Soon other things begin to happen. Others come to meet and to help him. He glimpses the spirits of relatives and friends who have already died, and a loving, warm spirit of a kind he has never encountered before, a being of light, appears before him. This being asks him a question, non-verbally, to make him evaluate his life and helps him along by showing him a panoramic, instantaneous playback of the major events of his life. At some point, he finds himself approaching some sort of barrier or border, apparently representing the limit between earthly life and the next life. Yet he finds that he must go back to the earth, that the time for his death has not yet come. At this point, he resists, for by now he is taken up with his experiences in the afterlife and does not want to return. He is overwhelmed by intense feelings of joy, love, and peace. Despite his attitude, though, he somehow reunites with his physical body and lives. Later, he tries to tell others, but he has trouble doing so. In the first place, he can find no human words adequate to describe these unearthly episodes. He also finds that others scoff, so he stops telling other people. Still, the experience affects his life profoundly, especially his views about death and its relationship to life. Now, that's the scenario of the 15 common elements common to all of these experiences, or at least a great many of them. He then takes each of those elements and expands them in the book. Now, interestingly enough, under the being of light, which was particularly intriguing to me, he says, what is perhaps the most incredible common element in the accounts I have studied, and is certainly the element which has the most profound effect upon the individual, is the encounter with a very bright light. Typically, at its first appearance, this light is dim, but it rapidly gets brighter until it reaches an unearthly brilliance. Despite the light's unusual manifestation, however, not one person has expressed any doubt whatsoever that it was a being of light. Not only that, it is a personal being. It has a very definite personality. The identification of the being varies from individual to individual and seems to be largely a function of the religious background, training, or beliefs of the person involved. A man who had had no religious beliefs or training at all prior to his experience, that is, one of the men whose experiences he's describing, a man who had no religious beliefs or training at all prior to his experience simply identified what he saw as, quote, a being of light. On page 97, he says, those who previously had some traditional conviction about the nature of the afterlife world seem to have moved away from it to some degree, following their own brushes with death. In fact, in all the reports I have gathered, not one person has painted the mythological picture of what lies hereafter. No one has described the cartoonist's heaven of pearly gates, golden streets, and winged harp-playing angels, nor a hell of flames and demons with pitchforks. That's very clever language, by the way. Although I'm not primarily critiquing this, it's very clever language to say mythological picture and cartoonists, and then describe in a number of details that are in the Bible and some that are not, and mix them all together. That's very fascinating. Clever technique. He says, in most cases, the reward-punishment model of the afterlife is abandoned and disavowed. That's significant. The reward-punishment model of the afterlife is abandoned and disavowed. Even when their most apparently awful and sinful deeds were made manifest before the being of light, the being responded not with anger and rage, but only with understanding and even with humor. Many seem to have returned with a new model and a new understanding of the world beyond, a vision which features not unilateral judgment, but rather cooperative development towards the ultimate end of self-realization. Not a model of judgment, but a model of cooperative development towards self-realization. Now, let me just quote a very important page. After he gives this scenario and expands the 15 elements, he then gives some suggested explanations for these experiences. How do you interpret these experiences? He starts with supernatural explanations, and then he goes on giving various types of explanations, psychological explanations, and physiological explanations, so forth. Under supernatural explanations, on page 156, he makes some rather important statements. Rarely someone in one of my audiences has proposed demonic explanations of near-death experiences, suggesting that the experiences were doubtless directed by such forces. As a response to such explanations, I can only say this. It seems to me that the best way of distinguishing between God-directed and Satan-directed experiences would be to see what the person involved does and says after his experience. God, I suppose, would try to get those to whom he appears to be loving and forgiving, Satan would presumably tell his servants to follow a course of hate and destruction. My subjects have come back with a renewed commitment to follow the former course, that is, love and forgiveness, and to disavow the latter, that is, hate and destruction. In the light of all the machinations with which a hypothetical demon would have to have carried out in order to delude his hapless victim, and to what purpose? He certainly has failed miserably, as far as I can tell, to make persuasive emissaries for his program. Now, that little statement there, a hypothetical demon would have to make all of these manipulations in order to produce these experiences. And then he says, and to what purpose? I think he's partially answered that already. That is, if these experiences cause people to conclude that instead of a reward-punishment model after life, you have something different, and instead of judgment, you have cooperative development towards self-actualization, and if, as he says on page 140, he says, through all my research, I have not heard a single reference to a heaven or hell, anything like the customary picture to which we are exposed in this society, which would be mainly a religious picture. And so to what purpose? I would say, well, if these experiences can convince people that the Bible is not true when it speaks of judgment, the Bible is not true when it speaks of heaven and hell and the need of salvation through Christ, I would say that's a pretty important purpose for a demon to try to develop such a scenario of experiences. So I'm not suggesting that as a whole critique of the book. What I'm suggesting is that that's an answer to this question, to what purpose would a demon produce such a thing. I'm not suggesting that these experiences are the result of the work of a demon. I'm saying that a demon would have a pretty good purpose if he accomplished this end, if he got to people not to believe in the Bible, not to believe in the God of the Bible, and in the Christ of the Bible, and in the judgment that God tells us that he's going to bring upon sin. Let me go to a couple of other books and see what they say before we pull it together and get a picture. Here's a book by Jess E. Weiss. Now, it's not Jesse Weiss, it's Jess E. Weiss, okay, W-E-I-S-S. And it's entitled The Vestibule, The Vestibule. And he has at the top, they were pronounced dead and returned to give wondrous evidence of life after life. It has a chapter by Elizabeth Kübler-Ross. And I'm turning to that chapter, which is entitled Chapter 5, The Experience of Death. This is an anthology, by the way, of various experiences and various essays on this subject. Dr. Kübler-Ross, in this chapter, The Experience of Death, says, one patient who was declared dead after inhalation of fumes from a leaky gas pipe recalled later that her late mother had appeared, smiled at her, and communicated to her that everything was fine. At that moment, all my fears vanished, the patient said. See, that's in the same line. Another man in his mid-40s who was pronounced dead after a massive heart attack recalled floating toward a passageway and approaching a bright light and voices. Then the gates went further and further away in spite of his wish that they stay. When he woke up, he understood why the gates had receded, but he added, when my time comes to die, I will die willingly. Then she says, in an attempt to gather more data about the questions of life and death, we questioned as many patients as possible to shed light into this unknown area. And then she mentions Mrs. S. Now, Mrs. S. is a very important personage in Dr. Kübler-Ross's experiences and in her descriptions of these experiences. Mrs. S. was the only patient, we'll meet her later a couple of places, by the way. I don't mean we'll meet her the way, well, Mrs. S. was the only patient among 500 whom we truly consider to have died from the standpoint of present medical knowledge. Now, here, among 500 people who claimed near-death or death experiences, Dr. Kübler-Ross felt that she was the only one that qualified. for having died from the standpoint of present medical knowledge. She was a patient in her 50s with a 20-year-old history of Hodgkin's disease and had been hospitalized on many occasions. We spent many hours talking to each other, and she volunteered to attend one of our seminars for members of the helping profession. About a year later, she had been hospitalized in a local hospital for internal bleeding problems. She recalled lying in her hospital room alone, getting weaker and weaker. She wondered whether she should call a nurse for help or let go. At this moment, a nurse entered her room, took one look at her, and ran out. Mrs. S.'s next recollection was the arrival of a resuscitation team, and they're working on her revival. She was able to give minute details of who entered her room, how they reacted, what they were doing on her body, while she herself floated a few feet above, observing the procedure performed on her body. She then floated away, unaware that the team gave up their efforts to revive her. She came back to consciousness as an orderly wheeled her body towards the morgue, and she lifted the bedsheet off her own face, which must have been a disconcerting experience. She adds a very straight but very humorous statement. She says, "For understandable reasons, no one desired to discuss the incident with her." Well, she was discharged shortly afterwards. We were informed of her death a few weeks later, a few days after her son's 16th birthday. Mrs. S. was no longer afraid to die. She did not become more religious in a churchy sense of the word, but she did impress me as a deeply religious person who appreciated life and loved people with a new intensity unknown to her prior to this close experience with death. By the way, this will come clearer as we look at Dr. Kubler-Ross's books on death and dying and questions and answers on death and dying. But Dr. Kubler-Ross considers herself to be a religious person, but not in the sense of any known religion. She considers herself to be religious in this sense, a person who appreciates life deeply and a person who loves people with a new intensity. That she considers to be a religious person. Well, that's a fairly general definition of religious. It certainly doesn't seem to fit with any known religion, as she would say. Now, there is another chapter in here, chapter 13, entitled Cardiac Arrest Remembered. It's from the Canadian Medical Association Journal of May 1971. Here is a 68-year-old man who previously had suffered no symptoms of coronary artery disease who awoke with aching pain in his left arm. He then later had a cardiac arrest, and he remembered in detail the events surrounding the cardiac arrest, and then he gives a vivid description of his experience. He says, "I had been admitted into the intensive care ward in the early evening." He looked at his wristwatch. He noticed it was a few minutes before four. He was lying flat on his back. He says, "I gave a very deep sigh, and my head flopped over to the right. I thought, why did my head flop over? I didn't move it. I must be going to sleep. This was apparently my last conscious thought. Then I am looking at my own body from the waist up, face to face, as though through a mirror in which I appeared to be in the lower left corner. Almost immediately, I saw myself leave my body, coming out through my head and shoulders. I did not see my lower limbs. The body, quote-unquote, leaving me was not exactly in vapor form, yet it seemed to expand very slightly once it was clear of me. It was somewhat transparent, for I could see my other body through it. Watching this, I thought, so this is what happens when you die, although no thought of being dead presented itself to me." Now, let me just pause there and point out something. Here, he is looking as a spectator, and he is seeing himself come out of himself. So there's himself lying there, there's the himself coming out of himself, and he, as a spectator, is looking on this. So you've got three centers of personality or consciousness here. "Suddenly, I am sitting on a very small object traveling at great speed out and up into a dull blue-gray sky at a 45-degree angle. I thought, it's lonely out here. Where am I going to end up? This is one journey I must take alone. My next sensation was of floating in a bright, pale, yellow light, a very delightful feeling. I continued to float, enjoying the most beautiful, tranquil sensation. Then, a few more aspects of the experience. But then afterward, he says, just a few comments as I think over what happened to me. I wonder if the bright yellow surroundings could have been caused by someone looking into my eyes with a bright light. He says, my brain must have stopped working after my heart stopped beating for me to experience these sensations. He says, if death comes to a heart patient in this manner, no one has cause to worry about it. I felt no pain, and while it was a peculiar experience, it was not unpleasant. The floating part of my sensation was so strangely beautiful that I said to a doctor later that night, if I go out again, don't bring me back. It's so beautiful out there. And at that time, I meant it. Well, you see that that experience is not quite the same experience as Mrs. S.'s experience, and yet there are similarities to it. And yet this cardiac patient wonders, since he says my brain must have kept operating even after my heart stopped beating for me to come alive again and to report these experiences, and he wonders whether there may have been some explanation for some of these experiences, which could be a normal explanation. In any case, another book is by Martin Ebon, E-B-O-N, entitled The Evidence for Life After Death. The Evidence for Life After Death. He has also a little question at the top, is there another life after life? He takes up these various other books, Moody's book, Jess Weiss's book, Dr. Kiebler-Ross's books, and he adds some material to them. For instance, Moody's book, Life After Life, Raymond Moody, Jr. He says, an evaluation appeared in the Humanist magazine, January-February 1977, written by Dr. Russell Noyes, Jr., who himself has studied a substantial series of cases of the type reported by Dr. Moody. Noyes asks pointedly, does Dr. Moody present evidence for survival of bodily death? And answers, no, he does not. First of all, he presents no confirmation that his subjects were dead, though they were undoubtedly close to it. Indeed, we have no modern-day instances of proven survival of bodily death. Let me read that again. We have no modern-day instances of proven survival of bodily death. Such proof need not be difficult. Rigor mortis is a well-recognized sign, for instance. We have no people returning from rigor mortis death. Noyes puts the material collected by Moody into the religio-physiological category of the mystical experience. These people, he writes, maintain that they knew the truth because they have been there. Now, among Dr. Kiebler-Ross's findings concerning death, he mentions a number of her findings, 10 in particular, and I'd like to mention just four of them. One finding by Dr. Kiebler-Ross, and we'll look more at her work, a person who has died once does not fear death anymore. That's one of Dr. Ross's, Kiebler-Ross's findings. Another one, everyone who dies is met by a loved one who has predeceased him, who has died before him. Another one, there are unseen loving guides within 2 feet of us at all times, so we never have to feel alone. That's interesting as one of Dr. Ross's findings. And then another one, in the next life, no one judges us, but we judge ourselves. Well, those are four of the 10 findings of Dr. Kiebler-Ross. But now further, I mentioned Dr. Kiebler-Ross's work on death and dying, and then I mentioned the book Questions and Answers on Death and Dying, and then Martin Ebon mentions a third work, Death, the Final Stage of Growth. Death, the Final Stage of Growth, published in 1975. And then he takes it from there. That is from the 1975 book, further on. In an interview which Kiebler-Ross gave to Kenneth L. Woodward for McCall's magazine of August 1976, she told of a woman who for years had suffered from Hodgkin's disease and had several times been near death. This woman told Ross that in the intensive care unit of a hospital, one afternoon a nurse saw that she was dying and rushed out of the room to summon help. And then she tells of this experience. This is, of course, Mrs. S., who is then mentioned, by the way. In the same interview, Dr. Ross told of the case of a young man in his 20s who was thrown out of the car so that when the police arrived at the scene, they found him sprawled in the middle of the street. His right leg was severed, and he showed no vital signs whatever. He was pronounced dead on the way to the hospital. As the man recovered, nevertheless, Dr. Ross was able to discover from him that he had floated out of his body over the accident scene, had observed rescue workers pulling other bodies out of the wrecked car, and even observed his own body minus one leg. Dr. Kiebler-Ross's endorsement of near-death experiences as indications of life beyond death have encountered skepticism. She told Woodward in this interview in 1976, "I had long suspected that the death of the body was not the end of life," although she said she was never a very religious person. Ross told Woodward, "What these near-death reports tell us about is only the first stage of life after death. I believe there are other stages." In a San Diego seminar on holistic medicine, Ross confessed that she had asked three visiting spirit creatures the night before what she should talk about. The visiting spirits had said, "Tell them about us." Now, that's 1976. Let me mention a couple other things in this book. We'll come back to Dr. Kiebler-Ross. Dr. Carlos Osis is the research director of the American Society for Psychical Research, the ASPR. And Dr. Osis researched and published a monograph entitled Deathbed Observations of Physicians and Nurses. This was published in 1961, and how he got this monograph together was by sending 10,000 questionnaires to doctors and nurses, about the equal number of doctors and nurses. He received from the 10,000 questionnaires 640 replies, and he did extensive follow-ups with telephone calls and with correspondence. In a summary at the end of his monograph on the dying patients whom doctors and nurses observed, Dr. Osis reported that elated moods were estimated by our respondents to occur in approximately 1 out of 20 dying patients. People felt better, felt elated, felt high. He found exaltation or extreme elevation of mood in 735 cases. In 884 cases, religious-oriented images that had nothing to do with human figures were dominant. These were along the lines of such traditional New Testament images as heaven and hell and so forth. The main part of the study dealt with visions of people. Visions of 1,370 hallucinatory persons were reported. Osis noted that terminal patients predominantly hallucinate phantoms representing dead persons who often claim to aid the patient's transition into post-mortem existence, after-death existence. He found that persons representing the dead during the deathbed experiences were, in the majority of cases, close relatives of the patient. He asked, why did the apparition come in these experiences? There were all kinds of rambling apparitions with no apparent purpose, but in the majority of cases, the patient's remarks suggested that the apparition wanted to take the dying patient away to another mode of existence by calling, beckoning, or demanding, which is rather interesting in terms of these experiences. The takeaway purpose of apparitions found during the initial U.S. survey came to 76% compared to other purposes. 76% of those responding who had these apparitional experiences responded that the apparition came to take them away. Then he made a transcultural study in India, and he said 79% responded in the same fashion. That is, that the apparition came to take them away, either by calling or beckoning or demanding. Now, that's fascinating in itself. The purpose, the basic characteristic of most apparitions was having the ostensible purpose of taking the patient away to another mode of existence. One can reflect upon what that apparition might represent, especially if it represents a personal being. However, he gives the case away in the last chapter of the book. The last chapter of the book is entitled, "Let Us Live and Die as If We Were Immortal." Now you say, well, what does he do with that title? Well, here's what he does with the title. He says, religious figures, philosophers, so-called spirit entities, and mystics of various types have given us descriptions of that unimaginable dimension, life after death. I frankly do not care much for any one of them. That is, of these descriptions. A case can be made for all of these hypotheses and for the information sources on which they are based, but there is a good deal of contradiction among them, and I personally do not see why I should have to accept or adopt any one of them. He says, nor need we, with all the information we now have, look upon death with an expectation of kindliness. He says, it is rather difficult to accept the view brought back by the witnesses of life after death that a rosy glow prevails on the other side, when the concept of mortal sin still hangs like a theological cloud over much of mankind. That's interesting. He says, neither birth nor death are easy. All our life is a fight for survival. Where then do we stand? We stand, I suggest, precisely where we have stood for all the thousands of years on which there is a record. He mentions the Epic of Gilgamesh, which illustrates man's essentially unchanged puzzlement over the very existence of death. How much of what you have read in the case histories in this book and other books is a reflection of hope against hope, of wishful thinking, of the desperate smile which masks fear and desperation? He says, I honestly do not know. I only know that people must have hope, or they might kill their children at birth. How torn we are, how fearful, and how often do we not know that we are lying, if only to ourselves, about our own death expectations and about the death of others? All this, I grant you, does not echo the optimism, the new hope, the promise of eternal life that permeates many of the preceding pages. But at the closing of a book like this, there is a time for facing basic questions humbly, but without hesitation. Death is a nettle to be grasped. Death forces us to answer the essential questions of life itself. And here are some of them. Is this all there is to it? Birth, suffering, and death? He says, life would have more obvious meaning, would give us greater incentive for living, for maturing, if we could be sure of life beyond death. If we anticipate the death of those we love, if we think of making their dying an easier path, or even the road to the greatest of blessings, then we might as well proceed on the assumption that death is not the end. Once we get away from the idea of death as punishment, eternity looks bright beyond our imagination. Why not indeed assume immortality as fact? It has much going for it, including our innermost needs, hopes, and half-certainties. I have given up thinking, despite the evidence presented in this book, that modern science will find totally convincing proof either for or against a survival of the human personality after death. Although science fails us on the question of survival after death, the hypothesis of immortality remains the very best there is. If we act and talk as if survival after death were a known fact, we do no more than admit the obvious, that we are ignorant and know it, that we are also optimistic and courageous. Most of our life goes on with a great as if governing it. As if our individual person were really important, as if our tasks were truly worthwhile, and as if we were immortal. Evidence of a world beyond us is, as we have seen, vast, various, and at times confusing. Deathbed observations, visions, mystical experiences, seance room phenomena, out-of-the-body experiences, apparitions, spontaneous and laboratory phenomena, all these are hints that tantalize, seem to convince, suggest another reality, but leave us within our own dimensions most of the time. And so his conclusion is, by all means, let us live and die as if we were immortal. It's an assumption that we have to make, but he says it's the very best assumption that there is, and it has much going for it. So the final conclusion is that all the evidence presented in the book does not really prove survival, but since it's a good assumption and we like to believe it, let's act upon it. Let's act as if it were true. If that offers a great deal of hope, you may rest in that. But I personally, I'm not excited about that. Now, on death and dying, I'm not going to quote from Kübler-Ross's book On Death and Dying. That has a very great deal of valuable material in it for people who want to help dying patients. That's very helpful. But now when we get into the questions and answers on death and dying, there she says some things that are germane to our subject here. And I want to quote them before I go to one other book, which brings us more up to date on Dr. Kiebler-Ross. These are questions and answers. They're categorized in chapters according to various subjects. Questions of humor and fear, faith and hope. These are taken verbatim, you know, from questions and answers in these various seminars that she holds. Question. On Sunday, I was talking to a returned missionary and mentioned to her that I was going to attend a seminar on death and dying. She immediately asked me if you were a Christian, that is Dr. Kiebler-Ross, and then went on to elaborate and say the only important thing was to know if the patient was ready and knew the Lord. I knew what she believes, but I could only conjure a mental picture of someone running into each patient's room asking if they were, quote, ready to die. How do you break through to these deeply religious people to make them see that there are more facets to dying than the one mentioned above? Dr. Kiebler-Ross's answer, I do not regard these people as truly religious, because if they were really such good Christians, they would accept every human being as thy neighbor and not judge them as good or bad depending on whether they were Christians or non-Christians. Now, that tells you a little bit about her view of Christianity. Now, I will say that she may feel she has a legitimate axe to grind. That is, if someone is interested only whether a person is ready and knows the Lord, but is totally disinterested in the person's ability to meet death, the person's preparation for death, that's something that's very close to Dr. Kiebler-Ross's heart. That's what she's been doing for years in her life. So if she were to say, well, that's the most important thing, but this other is also important, that would be one thing. But the answer in this way is somewhat revealing of her attitude toward Christianity. Here's a question. In your work with the dying patient, have you noticed a difference between the Christian dying patient and the non-Christian as to how they accept death? That's a good question. She answers, we have worked with many more Christian patients than non-Christians. The significant variable is not what you believe, but how truly and genuinely you believe. People who have believed in reincarnation or people from Eastern cultures and religions have often accepted death with unbelievable peace and equanimity, even at a young age, whereby many of our Christian patients have had difficulties in their acceptance of death. Only the few true, genuine religious people have accepted death with great peace and equanimity. Now, by the way, I underline those two because, see, if you back up and see what she says, that these people who believe in reincarnation and these people from Eastern cultures and religions, these have often accepted death with unbelievable peace and equanimity. And then three lines further, she says, only the few true, genuine religious people have accepted death with great peace and equanimity. See, now, there's an equation. People who have accepted death with great peace and equanimity, who are they? Well, among them, people who have believed in reincarnation and people who are from Eastern cultures and religions. She says, in our counseling, we have seen very few of these people, that is, the few true, genuine religious people, because we are usually called for consultations to those patients who are troubled. I would say that about 95% of our patients that we have studied have been a little bit religious, but not genuine and authentic. They then have the additional concern about punishment after death, regrets, and guilt about missed opportunities. Now, here's another question. In all your research on death, what is your personal belief of what happens after death? Answer, before I started working with dying patients, I did not believe in a life after death. I now do believe in a life after death beyond a shadow of a doubt. Question, deep down, do you believe that you are immortal? Answer, I believe that our bodies die, but the spirit or soul is immortal. Now, to throw some light on those answers that she gives, I have here a very recent book, Milborn Christopher's book, Search for the Soul. Milborn Christopher is a fascinating character. Milborn Christopher is a past president of the American Society of Magicians. He is a professional magician. From all that I've read, he is apparently a pretty good one. He's also, by the way, a member, and I suppose he's been a chairman, of the Occult Investigation Committee of the American Society of Magicians. They investigate occult phenomena and have again and again turned up evidence of fraud. And so this man is very fascinating. I have three of his books now, Milbourne Christopher, and I'm going to be referring to a number of things which he has discovered in his investigations as a magician, whose profession is deception. See, that's his profession. His intention is to deceive people. Okay? That's the kind of a person he says you need to investigate occult phenomena. He says scientists are the worst possible people to investigate occult phenomena. Scientists, he says, look where people tell them to look. He says, scientists, look right here at what you're doing instead of what you're doing over here with the other hand. He says, they're the worst possible people to investigate occult. He says, there ought to be a professional magician on every team investigating occult phenomena. And he makes his case pretty well by a couple of his books. Well, any case, this is a recent work. It's published by Thomas Crowell, New York. And this work is 1979, so it's fairly recent. Search for the Soul. I have found him most refreshing in his candor and frankness and his honest handling of the material. I know he's not a Christian, but I have a great deal of confidence in his written material as to what he says about the various matters. He also gives a great deal of evidence to support what he says, which is very helpful. He has a chapter in here entitled Dr. Elizabeth Kübler-Ross. Okay? This is fascinating. Dr. Elizabeth Kübler-Ross, chapter 13. A prayer was offered for Dr. Elizabeth Kübler-Ross during the 1977 conference of the Spiritual Frontiers Fellowship in Kansas City, Missouri. The assembled clergymen and lay people admired the expert on death and dying. They shared her conviction that the soul survives, but it is doubtful that any believed, that is, any of the people there at the Spiritual Frontiers Fellowship meeting, it is doubtful that any believed, as she now seemed to, that a dead woman could miraculously reappear in the flesh and walk, talk, and write like an ordinary human. You say, what is that all about? Well, that's why I said it's a curious way of starting the chapter. Now, let me proceed through this chapter, and we'll come to this. Dr. Kübler-Ross told James Crenshaw when he interviewed her for the April 1977 issue of Fate magazine, Fate, about a strange encounter with a living dead woman. Then he tells James Crenshaw about Dr. Ross's description of the account of Mrs. S. Here we come back against it. He tells the story, and he says, Milbourne Christopher says, that was how the story appeared in the book, but there was more to it, as James Crenshaw discovered during his interview. This was in April 77, the interview. Dr. Kübler-Ross told him that in 1968, she decided to concentrate on another branch of medicine, that is, other than her constant work with the dying. It had subjected her to a tremendous strain. She decided to concentrate on another branch of medicine. Standing in a hospital corridor near a clergyman friend as he waited for the elevator, she turned to tell him about this decision. Before she could speak, Mrs. S. materialized beside her. The dead woman was as real as the minister. The clergyman entered the elevator. Mrs. S. went with Dr. Kübler-Ross to her office. Sitting in the chair on the far side of the desk, Mrs. S. made her promise to go on with her compassionate mission. Perhaps not trusting her senses, Dr. Kübler-Ross asked the visitor from the afterlife to write a note to another physician. Mrs. S. wrote a message, smiling. She wrote a message. Then the living dead woman left, not by dissolving in a misty haze, but by walking out through the open door. In November 1977, an interview that Peggy Taylor and Rick Ingrassi had with her during the Rocky Mountain Healing Arts Festival in August was printed in the magazine New Age. That is New Age, November 1977. 3 years earlier, she had told them, the pressures of one of her five-day seminars had exhausted her. The sessions extended from early morning to far past midnight. Late the last night, there was a ceremony and a celebration. Everyone gathered around a blazing bonfire and tossed cones from a pine tree into the flames, symbolizing the rejection of negative aspects of their personalities. As they sat by the fire, eating freshly baked bread and drinking wine, ego wounds were healed and an exuberant emotion of oneness with God and nature prevailed. At 5 a.m., the tired psychiatrist tried to leave, but a dying patient insisted that she hold her hand. After doing so for perhaps 15 minutes, she went to her room. As soon as she was in bed, the door was flung open by a young woman who had been deeply moved by the fireside rites. The rising of the sun would mark her birthday, she said. Not the anniversary of the day she had been born, but the beginning of a new life. She asked the psychiatrist who had made this epic event possible to join her as the rays of the sun drove the darkness from the sky. Too fatigued to get up, this was a little after 5 a.m., too fatigued to get up, Dr. Kubler-Ross told the woman that she could sit by her window. Almost as soon as the psychiatrist closed her eyes, her inner self was propelled from her body. Floating above it, she relaxed and saw a fabulous sight. Spirits, working as efficiently as mechanics on an automobile assembly line, removed tired and worn parts from her and replaced them with new material. 90 minutes later, she awakened in bed, feeling younger and better than she had in years. The mouth of the birthday celebrant by the window was agape. She told Dr. Kubler-Ross that she had stopped breathing. Robert Monroe, and here's another aspect, Robert Monroe has a radio station in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and a 640 estate in Charlottesville, Virginia. He has had astral adventures. He's written about them in a book called Journeys Out of the Body, published in 1971. Dr. Kubler-Ross went to Charlottesville, and in the November 1977 issue of New Age, she said that she went there 2 years after the spirit workman had repaired her body. Her first out-of-the-body experience had not been premeditated. She was eager to learn whether she could schedule them at will. See, that was the first one when she floated above her body and the workmen repaired them. So now she wondered whether she could schedule these out-of-the-body experiences. She and the other students, that is to this consciousness separation clinic, she and the other students reclined on a waterbed in an isolated room. Wires ran from the electrodes on her head to a polygraph. Sounds amplified to induce the proper mood reached her through earphones. Firmly believing that she could master the technique of quick detachment, she intended to zoom up into the clouds on the following day. Resting again on the waterbed, primed by her urge to project, she took off like a rocket and shot through the ceiling and into the sky. Streaking far above the earth, she suddenly remembered that she had not followed one of the basic instructions. She was traveling horizontally, not vertically. No problem. She tilted herself up into the right position without losing speed. Into the far reaches of outer space, beyond the areas explored by astronauts, she became exhilarated. She saw sights no one else had ever seen and heard somewhere in the distance two words, Shanti Nilaya, being repeated again and again. She returned to her body refreshed, elated, and vibrant. Someone in Virginia told her that Shanti meant peace, but Nilaya was still a mystery until she went to Berkeley, California. Then she was informed that the words were a Sanskrit term for ultimate home of peace. Late in 1977, Dr. Kubler-Ross established an institute for the terminally ill in Valley Center, California. She called it Shanti Nilaya. Dr. Milburn asks, what is one to make of fantastic tales like these? Obviously, Dr. Kubler-Ross believes that she had these experiences. Is there a rational explanation for them? He says, a medium told her that her mother had died when she was young, and she was chided for ignoring her mother's headaches. She became fascinated with accounts of psychic phenomena. Some people read books on diseases and imagine that they have every symptom described. Some people don't even have to read books. They just have to hear someone else tell about their symptoms, and they say, Well, others... Others read stories of the occult and are sure that they, too, have mysterious powers. The mind is susceptible to suggestive influences. Perceptions are altered by beliefs. Psychiatrists and psychoanalysts interpret dreams and fantasies as reflections or aspirations, fears or repressed emotions. Dr. Elizabeth Kübler-Ross merits high praise for her compassionate work with the dying. Her empathy lightens their emotional burdens and enables the terminally ill and those who love them to deal more effectively with issues all too often ignored. Many of her friends are distressed by her fascination with more esoteric areas. One who expressed concern was told that this was a sign of his own insecurity and that those who dare to venture beyond the known are always misunderstood. One need not be a psychiatrist to understand that the course of her life has changed and that the prayer said for her by those attending the 1977 Conference of the Spiritual Frontiers Fellowship was for a humanitarian who in recent years seems to have strayed beyond the remotest boundary of their faith. She has really gone far beyond the beliefs of any of the people in the Spiritual Frontiers Fellowship. Time Magazine, November 12th, 1979, page 81, under the section Behavior, entitled The Conversion of Kübler-Ross. The subtitle, The Conversion of Kübler-Ross from Thanatology is a study of death, to seances and sex. It is an absolutely astounding article. Absolutely astounding. Permit me to quote from this article, which appeared in Time, November 12, 1979. Her surprise bestseller of 1969, On Death and Dying, made her well known. The thanatology boom, that's the study of death, of the 1970s made her famous. Her outline of the five phases of death, from angry denial to final acceptance, is routinely taught at school and hospital seminars. Several years ago, the psychiatrist raised eyebrows by concluding that death is not so final after all. When people die, Kübler-Ross declared, they very simply shed their body much as a butterfly comes out of its cocoon. Her growing conviction that the living could communicate with the dead led her to dabble in spiritualism at her retreat north of San Diego. Now Kübler-Ross, who refers to herself as an, quote, immortal visionary and modern cartographer of the river Styx. A cartographer is a map maker. The river Styx was connected in Greek mythology with death. She's a modern map maker of the river of death. Kübler-Ross has apparently lost any remaining credibility with her professional colleagues. The reason? Her close association with Jay Barham, who claims to be a psychic and conducts seances that include sexual intercourse between participants and entities from the spirit world. Barham, 50 years old, is a former sharecropper and aircraft worker who founded the Church of the Facet of Divinity 4 years ago. In his first meeting with Kübler-Ross, he introduced her to her own personal spirit entity, Salem. Greatly impressed, she talked her husband into buying 42 acres of land just across a lake from a 9-acre ranch used by Barham and his wife, Martha. Kübler-Ross called her property Shanti Nilaya, which is a Sanskrit term meaning home of peace, and made it a center for workshops on death and dying. Barham conducts group sessions where, he says, spirit entities materialize by cloning themselves from cells of his body. Spirits take cells from his body and reproduce him in spirit form, but materialize. Participants in the sessions, many well-educated, if gullible, middle-class professionals, have had occasional doubts
about these spirit entities. But most people put aside their doubts. "I needed to believe," admitted one woman in the group. "It was a sense of being loved unconditionally." Barham also taught participants that they had all lived during the time of Jesus and had been among his disciples. Says one woman, recruited as a channel for the entities, "He appealed to my ego and really hooked me." Kübler-Ross, quoting from the article in People magazine of October 29, 1979, Kübler-Ross is unswerving in her belief in an afterlife. Until meeting Barham, she said, she had encountered only one spirit entity named Willie, but has since met three others, Ienka, Salem, and Mario. She also maintains that she lived during the time of Christ as Isabel, one of his teachers. One of the teachers of Christ. Well,
no, it's just unbelievable. I mean, Kübler-Ross has done a lot of good work. I mean, she's done a lot of good work. But when you read this, what you see is she's gone off the deep end. She's gone off the deep end. And we gave little indications of where she was heading. Do you remember? In 74 and then 75, then 77. Here is 79. Well, that brings us a little more up to date on Dr. Kübler-Ross's experiences. What is one to make out of all of this indeed? If you try to evaluate all of these experiences by experiences, then it's a standoff. It's a standoff. You say, you have your experiences, I have my experiences. Well, who is to judge? You know, your experiences are valid for you, mine are valid for me. And then we go on our way, everybody believing his or her experiences. There's no basis of judgment in experience per se for that. There must be some objective norm or standard of judgment as to how we are to understand all of these things, especially when we talk about life after death. Personally, I believe that the Bible is the only objective standard to tell us what happens after a person physically dies. Now, we have yet to look at the question of the states of persons who are righteous, who believe in Christ, who trust savingly in Him. What happens to them after their physical death? And what happens to the unrighteous after physical death? That's what we're going to look at next. And we're going to look at it in the light of Scripture. We're going to see what the Bible says. That will give us a standard by which to evaluate many of these things that we have read tonight. There is one other point that I should make, just one point. We're not going to develop it. So, 4 Arabic 4, following physical death, human beings continue to exist in both an intermediate state and a final or eternal state. Now, it's the burden of the next two major points to unpack that statement.